Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today on the podcast, I have with me Sean Williams. Sean is the founder and CEO of AutoGen AI, a generative AI startup backed by Blossom Capital and Salesforce Ventures. In today's episode, we talked about how Sean only learns lessons by falling over himself, why managers are paid to make up numbers and then they're paid to deliver them.
But you had this fantastic line, Sean, managers are paid to make up numbers, then they are paid to deliver them.
Not allowing himself to get distracted by million other opportunities. Turning down hundreds of investors before choosing to work with Blossom Capital. Why linguistic engineering and the difference between argument and rhetoric has a massive application to LLMs.
Even if large language models get no smarter over the next 10 years, the stuff you can do with them, what we call linguistic engineering, which I think is a term we've made up or at least sort of repurposed, It's just so exciting. You don't have to be doing stuff which is, you know, sort of, again, you don't have to be doing stuff which is PhD level astrophysics to be doing brand new stuff that no one's ever thought of before, which is coming up with these remarkable results.
And why context windows are super important when you're scaling your team. Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Sean, really great to have you in the studio with me today.
Great to be here.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to this because it's been a while and a long time coming. So first off the bat, you successfully scaled and exited Corndell, your first business, to a private equity investor at the time with relatively lean cap table of less than 40 investors. Now that the dust has settled, what do you wish you had done differently? And what are the lessons you've learned that you're taking into AutoGen?
Yeah, well, look, I think the first time you do anything, you have no idea what you're doing. The second time, hopefully it becomes a bit easier. But I also think, well, at least for me, I'm one of those people who only learns lessons by falling over myself. And people can tell you where all the pitfalls lie and you give one ear to them, but you don't really believe them. It's only by making the mistakes that you learn. At least that's for me, unfortunately, most of the time. So look, I mean, there are a million things that I would do differently. I'd have set up the share structure slightly differently in the first place. I'd have taken more time doing due diligence over kind of the company that eventually acquired us. I mean, there's all sorts of things I'd have done differently every day in the business. But, you know, at the end of the day, founded a business in September 2016 and sold it 4 years later. And that was what we'd set out to do. And we delivered essentially on the vision, and we delivered on exactly what we promised our original shareholders we'd do.
That's not a bad result, to say the least. Certainly seen worse in 4 years. Let's just to dig into that a little bit, right? So, and we're going to talk about kind of AutoGen and the venture journey a little bit. But when you founded Corndell, you had a very clear idea of what it meant to build a business, to take capital, to take investment from external sort of parties, whether institutional or individual. So what was your philosophy? How did you think about sort of building a company back in 2016?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd come from an outsourcing world. So I'd come from a place where margins are very tight and you need to make more money than you spend. Business model, absolutely. Yeah. I was very, very conscious that I was taking on people's money that I needed to then give it back to them and give it back to them with a return. So at Corndell, we raised some money, a couple of million pounds, from a group of about 35 different individual investors under SEIS and EIS. And I promised them that I would seek an exit for them within 4 years once the tax breaks became available. And we promised them that we would make them a 10x return, which is essentially exactly what we did.
So I mean, how, I guess at the start of your journey, how could you be so confident that you were going to get to this 4-year exit? And the reason I ask is we've previously had on the podcast Nick Telson, who again, founded and exited Design My Night. And he had a very similar story. He took two rounds of angel capital, but his desire and objective and goal was, I'm going to build this business. I'm going to take very minimal capital, enough to basically get the business to where it needs to go. And then I'm going to seek an exit. But I think, you know, when you start building a business, it's very hard to kind of have that goal of, you know, 4 years, I'm going to find a 10x exit for you. How did you think through, I guess, the parameters of when that could happen, how it would happen, who it would happen to, right? Because like starting a business, yeah, of course, the ultimate goal we all hope is you're either driving lots of cash on income, yeah, or you have some sort of a capital event which returns liquidity back to yourself and to your investors. So yeah, what gave you the confidence that you're going to be able to do that?
I think I was just very naive. So we had a plan. We had what we thought was a superb opportunity in this introduction of the apprenticeship levy, hypothecated tax. We were pretty sure we knew what we were doing. We were pretty sure there were no decent competitors in the market space. And then we just made some assumptions. I mean, we put some numbers into Excel and we said, well, what if we take on 80 new apprentices every week? And what would that look like? And what would we grow to? And then what would be a reasonable exit multiplier on a business like that? And how much do we think the cost base would be? And so we made some broad brush assumptions. And then I had a boss at a big corporate that I used to work for. She had lots of, you know, kind of fantastic strengths. She could also be a difficult kind of individual to work for.
Corporate boss,
but yeah, she had this fantastic line: Sean, managers are paid to make up numbers and then they are paid to deliver them. And I actually think, you know, kind of I have a lot of time for that. And I think, you know, maybe sort of placing it differently, you know, you come up with a vision, you write some numbers down on an Excel spreadsheet or the back of a cigarette packet. I mean, you know, literally you're making up the future. And then your job is to make sure that that's the future that attains. And you know, and of course, that is, look, I'm not, you know, not saying that that's easy. It requires a massive amount of, you know, agility and flexibility and effort and luck and hard work and all of those sorts of things. But, you know, we always, you know, we stuck to our plan as we had it. And it was a very deliberate strategy. And actually, one thing we did superbly well at Corndell was we stuck to the strategy.
Yeah.
There were all sorts of people telling us, oh, you should do this, or you should do sales apprenticeships, or you should do an ISA. No. We're just going to stick to our guns. We're going to do the thing we do. We're going to stick to the plan and we're going to do that superbly. And a lot of what I did was not getting distracted and not allowing the business to get distracted. Because, you know, often I say this to people, most business isn't intellectually interesting. It's about just doing, cranking the handle, doing the, just repeatedly doing the right thing. It's like, I know you're a runner because I kind of read all your stuff. So, you know, running's about putting one leg in front of the other and keeping going. I think business is much the same a lot of the time.
I think it is. And what's really interesting to me is, because I guess, and we'll get into this when we talk about AutoGen in a second, but you didn't set out to build Corndell with a venture capital mindset, right? When the venture capital mindset, I guess what I'm talking about when I talk about the venture capital mindset is founders who basically are shooting for the moon, going for that $1 billion kind of exit, and therefore aren't actually putting one foot in front of the other. They're actually, you know, they are throwing fuel on a fire so they can get jet skis so they can keep up with whatever it is that they're trying to do, and not necessarily worrying about the cost or the wastage or the efficiency that is lost as a result of doing that, right? So I mean, I have to say, I do love that quote about managers being paid to make up numbers and then paid to deliver them. It feels like you've just sort of, you know, to use the awful phrase, open the kimono on the world of CFOing as well. But that's essentially it. I mean, like, and the reality is, no person on the planet can sit here and tell anyone that they can forecast to absolute accuracy what's going to happen over the next 1, 3, 5 years. I mean, find me a person that knew what was going to happen in 2020 in December 2019, and I'll find you a very, very rich person. But, you know, that clearly didn't happen. No one picked up what was going to happen. So I think what's really wonderful, and I guess in the period that we're living in at the moment and living through, where the sort of whole venture capital zeitgeist of just, you know, capital as a weapon being thrown into lots of businesses, actually setting them up often not for success but actually for failure, we've come off of those sort of heady days. And I think what's really wonderful now is lots of founders and businesses are starting to think exactly in the way that you were thinking when you built Corndell. However, you've now kind of flipped the script on that a little bit, right? So, you know, you've raised, you know, a ton of money at AutoGen. You know, you talk about generative AI as a current of history, not just a fad, but you have raised two rounds at significant markups within less than 6 months of each other in 2023. So for an external viewer, it would be hard not to wonder if you are actually riding the zeitgeist. So tell me why you don't think that's the case at AutoGen.
Yeah, well, look, I've never been fashionable. So as soon as something becomes not the zeitgeist, that's probably my time to do it. Look, I think, Microsoft rode the zeitgeist of the home computer. Google rode the zeitgeist of the internet. Netflix rode the zeitgeist of fast streaming. Similarly, also Gen AI is riding the zeitgeist of this magical new technology, large language models, to build a company which, in the same way that nobody writes a financial model without using Excel, in 10 years' time, nobody is going to write proposals without using AutoGen AI.
Mm.
And that's the opportunity ahead of us, and that's the business ahead of us. And it's just so exciting to be inventing the future every day I go into work. I work with the smartest people on the planet in the most exciting technology. And even if large language models get no smarter over the next 10 years, the stuff you can do with them, what we call linguistic engineering, which I think is a term we've made up or at least sort of repurposed, it's just so exciting. You don't have to be doing stuff which is, you don't have to be doing stuff which is PhD level astrophysics to be doing brand new stuff that no one's ever thought of before, which is coming up with these remarkable results. So if you look at we did retrieval augmented generation before most people in the world, and we got to that through philosophy, not through technology. It's so exciting to do that. I recruited the first prompt engineer in the UK. We feel we're at the start of something so exciting, and it's just great to be part of that. Now, look. Is that then high? So you need a level of capital to be able to do that. Of course, it's higher stakes with a greater probability of success, but I think a greater probability of failure. But I think there's all sorts of lessons you can take. I mean, I think, good thing working for an outsourcer, you're making 2.5% margins, is it gives you a discipline with cash. We're not doing Super Bowl adverts. That's not what we're spending the money on.
Yeah.
We're spending the money on engineers. We're spending the money on salespeople. We're spending the money on things which, where we repeatably can work and where we can do the measurement, and where we've got it wrong, we can cut the expenditure quickly.
Yeah.
So I think there's all sorts of lessons around how do you deploy capital well. People often say, well done on getting funded and well done on deploying capital. I mean, spending money. Spending money is not hard. Spending money wisely to make sure you maximize your chance of getting a return is a more interesting intellectual challenge.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, talking about these large rounds that you've raised, you and I have had multiple conversations, both on and offline, about building businesses. And to some extent, you have or had an almost visceral aversion to taking on external capital, essentially taking the view that if you do, the job then is to build a successful business rather than build to the next fundraising milestone, which sadly is what I think a lot of founders were getting used to.
Yeah.
So given you weren't intending to take venture, talk me through why you switched your view.
It was the size of the opportunity ahead of us. So I saw that when I started the business, I thought we had the opportunity to get 100, 200 customers to be able to, deliver a great piece of software to them and then get swallowed up by whoever was going to be the Google or the Facebook or the Amazon of generative artificial intelligence for business. Then I saw that actually no one else was out there and we should be the Google or the Facebook or the Netflix for generative AI for business.
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially, you saw it almost as it's relatively similar to what you did at Cornell. You saw that there was a gap. You were very early in. There was nothing on the horizon that suggested anyone was doing this, and you basically went for a land grab. What are the sort of customers that AutoGen targets in that case?
Yeah, so I mean, we've got people across all sectors. So half of the big four consultancies are our customers. We've got some of the largest construction companies in the world. Of course, some of the biggest outsourcers, people like Serco, who are one of the 40 strategic suppliers to the UK government. They have found 85% productivity gains using our software. Mm. So this is game changing, share price moving improvements through this remarkable application of this remarkable technology.
Yeah. And I mean, so when you talk about bid writing, are you talking very specifically about bid writing proposals for sort of governmental contracts, or does this translate to more general bid writing, contracting for SMEs or for mid-cap businesses? I'm like, where do you see this
going? So about 60% of our customers are doing business to government and about 40% business to business. And actually about 1 or 2% is with grant writing and fund writing applications. So as I say, we've got megacorps, FTSE 100 company like Serco, then right through to, you know, small charities who are using us to get funding from a local authority or from a charitable trust.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, going back to this sort of question on the fundraising, though, you know, the rounds that you were able to close last year in 2023, I don't think you'd actually even, I mean, you weren't actively fundraising when those rounds happened. So talk me through kind of what happened and how it was that these VCs, and very, very blue chip VCs at that, kind of came to you and said, we want a piece of this pie. What?
Yeah, so we got approached, we were being approached by a lot of people. And about 50% of the VCs who approached me got either my name wrong or the name of the business wrong. So, you know, kind of there's a little tip. If you want to approach businesses, try and do the basic homework. And then, you know, kind of another 90% of the 50% were, you know, kind of hadn't done their research, or didn't look interesting. And then Blossom Capital approached us.
And this is Ophelia.
It was Imran who first approached us.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll have an hour chat with him. I'll be honest, I didn't think anything was going to come of it, but he massively impressed me. So, as you say, I didn't like institutional capital. I had an aversion to it from previous experiences, but I realized that there were investors and investors, and they genuinely say this, I'm not blowing smoke up them. The first time I met Imran, I was just incredibly impressed by him. So I wanted to have follow-up meetings, and then he introduced me to Ophelia, who again is just an enormously impressive individual. They're smart. I'd heard the term conviction investors, but I didn't really understand it. You know, people who actually understand that it's, you know, founders who understand their businesses best, people who give really practical sage advice, like investors I actually want to listen to, because they can really, really help me and are prepared to roll their sleeves up and then just have this enormous amount of knowledge. So I hadn't been planning to raise, and essentially Blossom got in early with a term sheet, and it was, you know, that they were partners I wanted to work with. I took a lot of references on them, and everyone said the same thing. They said, you know, they share your ambition, they, you know, share your belief in what makes great businesses. So it was a really kind of a very, very good partnership.
Yeah.
It felt like a partnership.
I mean, there's a massive lesson to be learned there. I think, you know, a lot of founders don't necessarily understand the difference between capital and smart capital, or capital and valuable capital, right? You're in a position where you were being approached, so you weren't out there sort of, you know, trying to push for term sheets. So you had a level of comfort, I guess, and ability to pick and choose, where most founders certainly, you know, I don't think would have that kind of that ease of being able to choose who their investor is. But even with that said, it is remarkably important to think through the type of investor that you want on your cap table, because they're not just on your cap table, they're on your board potentially, and they're in your business, right? They are going to be advocates. They are going to be people that down the track, if you have future investors, those investors are going to call and ask what they think of you, what they think of the business. And to your point, if they're involved, if they're hands-on, if they're actually adding value beyond the capital, then they're opening doors that hopefully make the business bigger, better, brighter than if you'd just taken the capital alone. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, this is, it's, you know, for normal people, kind of like, you know, this is, it's a complete power differential. It is very, very hard for normal people when you've got a £10 million check on the table to say no.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that is extremely difficult. And I was in an enormously privileged position from my previous business that I personally didn't need to have any money. And the business, with the trajectory we were on, was going to be profitable on our, even on that current trajectory.
Yeah, so before you took the capital in, you were going to be profitable by the end of last year.
Exactly. Right. So we didn't need the money, which of course puts you in a strong position.
Yeah.
Now, you know, if you're burning cash at, you know, £1 million a month and you've got £3 million left in the bank account, then you're wondering how you're going to make payroll in a couple of months' time. That's a different position.
And you've been in that position before yourself, right? At Quandell, I think.
Yeah, I think, I think I said to you, I still remember it was September 2018 when we became cash generative, and we were down to our last 150k in the bank, and payroll was like 120k, something like that. So it was pretty. Can I say squeaky bum? That's the technical term, I believe. So you know, I still remember it, and that's a different level of sleepless nights. I mean, you got, you know, people are paying their mortgages based on you. At the time, I was paying my mortgage based on it, right? You know, it's it's serious life stuff. Kind of all of the people involved. Now, of course, you know, kind of we're in a different position with AutoGen AI. It's a different sort of pressure. It's actually, most of the pressure is kind of self-administered. It's, wow, we're in this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity with this once-in-a-lifetime technology. We want to take it to the stars. But, you know, we're not going to run out of cash in the next few years.
I think you're okay in that.
Yeah, exactly. So
but presumably that also means that you are unlikely to take on more capital over the next couple of years as well, right? So you have enough dry powder to keep you going.
I think it depends. So again, we've just started putting sales operations in Australia and in the US, and we've tripled the size of our UK sales team. So we'll see how those pay off. Now, if we can quite quickly start to show, wow, we put boots on the ground in a new territory, and within 6 months they're, you know, profitable, and
we can do that here and here,
right? And then you suddenly go, well, do we want to do that in 5 more countries, or do we want to do that in 50 more countries? And we tripled the size of the team in the UK. That worked. Do we want to then go bigger bets? And of course, there are all sorts of operational challenges and difficulties with those things. And then there's always the risk that you don't move fast enough, and someone moves faster than you. So, you know, these are interesting challenges.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, you said it right at the top, right? Like, this was a once in a lifetime. You were the crest of the wave rather than riding the wave, right? Like, I think that's the point.
We released 6 weeks before ChatGPT came out.
Right. So you're ahead of your time. But you were ahead of your or at least the rest of the world, right? The rest of the world suddenly had, you know, access to ChatGPT, and we're like, oh my gosh, this is absolutely incredible. But you started early enough that you're able to do that land grab early enough and cement yourselves as the only option of choice within this space. And that's where you saw, okay, actually this could be much bigger, much better, much, much larger than you had anticipated. And I think, you know, I remember you and I talking about this. You know, I think you said to me you set up AutoGen because you wanted to play around with the technology more than anything else, right? Like, but then once you started seeing, okay, well, actually this business is a business. It's not just, you know, playing around with the technology. But B, the size of the opportunity is so large, why not try and take advantage of that?
Exactly. And we won an award, this AI grant, and they flew us over to San Francisco, and we were there with, you know, 20 other company founders, and we saw, you know, the founder of Figma and founder of Midjourney and the, you know, kind of all of these people who'd built billion-dollar businesses. And you go, why have they bought them? And you realize, oh, wow, it's because they're trying to put us in this environment where we set our ambitions higher. And, you know, when I say to kind of UK colleagues and UK friends, oh, I sold Corndell for, you know, $50 million, they go, well done. It's Silicon Valley. You tell them you sold your previous business for $50 million. They go, sorry mate. Like, you failed, right? I mean, you know, there are good things and bad things to that. But you know, it's a...
they have a different outlook on...
Right, different scale. Why shouldn't it be us changing the world? And, you know, kind of you've got to have the right people, and you've got to have the right product, you've got to have the right idea, you've got to be in the right place at the right time, and you need a big dollop of luck. But... you know, this feels like the start of the internet. You know, of course there are going to be, you know, lots of companies that crash and burn. There can be lots of silly ideas.
Yeah.
But you're also going to create the next batch of companies that run the world out of this innovation.
Well, I mean, not even run the world, but I mean, just change the way we think about things. I mean, a couple of friends of mine, some who've been on this podcast before again, were very, very early investors in, what's it called? 11 Labs. Right. So, you know, these guys are doing essentially seamless artificial intelligence generated dubbing and not just dubbing. Right. So you're dubbing the voice in the accent of the actor, but you're also manipulating their facial features. So it looks like they are speaking the language into which they've been dubbed. I'm like, it is absolutely phenomenal. Hey guys, sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to introduce you to our sponsor. This episode is sponsored by Emerge One. Emerge One CFOs partner with VC-backed founders from seed to series B to manage and raise capital and plan how it should be deployed, controlling cash so that they can do what they do best to scale strategically. You can find them at emergeone.co.uk. That's emergeone.co.uk. Okay, let's get back to the episode. We actually, in this podcast, you know, early days, because I started recording here in sort of January of last year, February of last year, you know, we were talking about, should I do one in Italian? Should I do one in Spanish? And then like this all came out. I'm like, okay, no, screw that. we don't need to do that anymore. It's being done for us. But yeah, I look, and I think to touch on one of your points, I think this is a serious point to raise, right? I saw an article yesterday, I think $10 billion worth of businesses are delisting from the London Stock Exchange. They're looking at relisting in the US because there just isn't appetite amongst private investors and the public markets in the UK and in Europe more generally for large scale tech businesses. We tend to undervalue the opportunity. We've had a couple of investors come on, whose entire philosophy is you must build your business either with a view to expanding into the US immediately or with boots on the ground in the US day one, because that's the only place you're going to be able to A, scale, but B, also raise the sort of capital that you may need. But equally, when you look to exits, it's the only place where it has large enough businesses by whom you can be acquired, let alone the public markets where you can list on, right? And I think the problem here in the UK is, you know, it's that, you know, we're a nation of shopkeepers mentality. That's kind of the vibe that I get. And okay, today, the vibe is very different from what it was even 8 years ago for a number of reasons, which I won't sort of try and rehash on this. But I'm sure I've talked about Brexit more than enough on this podcast in the past. But it does feel like we have regressed a little bit in terms of that ambition, right? You don't, you know, we applaud some of the entrepreneurs, but often it's the entrepreneurs that have done things slightly shadily, like who tend to have political connections rather than the ones that have actually just like, you know, gone hard, really tried to build. And yes, we celebrate 9-figure exits to your point, or 8-figure exits. So like 50 million, 100 million, 200 million, but there aren't any $1 billion exits. Like we rarely see those here. And I think there's almost a bit of shame in the UK psyche about seeing those sort of numbers. I don't quite know what it is. I mean, I would love if AutoGen were to build to a scale where it can exit for those sort of numbers, but I would absolutely question whether it will do that in the UK versus elsewhere. I mean, would you agree?
Look, I have to say, finance is your area, not sure. My area. So I will be taking advice on, you know, when we're doing our 10 billion kind of IPO, then I will take the advice of others about whether to list in London or New York.
If I can ring the bell, I'll be happy
exactly.
To give you that advice.
Wherever lets me ring the bell, kind of, I'll be happy. Yeah. But you know, very, very, very genuinely, you know, it's I'll stick to the things I'm good at, which is building businesses and, you know, delighting customers, building an absolutely brilliant piece of software, making sure that users love using that software, making sure that customers see the value out of that software. You know, I think if you do all of those things right, then the other success metrics come with that.
They come with that. Yeah, but I guess the point that I'm almost sort of trying to allude to is like, if you're a founder that is building this sort of generational business, are there other founders in the UK that you can like, hey, listen, mate, like this is going on. I've got this term sheet from these guys, or like, you know, we just scaled to 1,000 people. How the hell do we do this? Like, or is that conversation always going to happen with someone in the US?
I actually think there's quite a good, I mean, there are a good kind of like half dozen kind of founders in the UK who I've talked to around, you know, kind of some of these things. Cause you know, again, it's that classic, you've got to be in the same sort of position really to, you know, to really understand it and have credibility in it. So I think there are a few.
Okay. So maybe it's not quite as bad as I thought or that I'm making out to be. Let's move on from all things sort of financial, as it were. although I think we may come back to it. You're not a technologist. You came from a humanities background, as I did. Talk me through your thoughts on why this means you are ideally placed to work with LLMs, which you describe as cultural technology. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it earlier. What do you actually mean when you talk about linguistic engineering?
Yeah, so I'm not sure I'm ideally placed. I think if I was doing deep tech, I'd be a mathematician or an astrophysicist, as all the people doing the deep tech are. I think one of the reasons why it took a long time for large language models to become adopted, it took the ChatGPT interface. But people have been playing with GPT-3 rather, kind of for quite a long time before that. It's just it wasn't very good at maths and it isn't very good at mathematical.
Still isn't,
Reasoning. Yeah. And so people didn't, because you got people who didn't understand humanities, they'd not got any education in the humanities. And actually, in many ways, had sort of been taught to look down on the humanities. People didn't realize what they got in terms of a language engine, in terms of something that could read and write. Mm. And reading and writing is so fundamental.
I mean, it's in the name. It's a large language model.
Right. Yeah, no. Absolutely. So look, my degree was in philosophy. Mm. So we did a lot on the structure of language and a lot around argument and around then, obviously we're talking about the difference between rhetoric and sort of what we might think of as real argument. But of course, in studying rhetoric, you learn what persuades. Structure of language. I studied kind of a lot of Wittgenstein, and I think really understanding things like context windows is really understanding that man plays many different language games, which is a classic Wittgenstein, and different language games have different rules.
Yeah.
Right? And the language game of how do you write winning corporate prose is a different game to how do you write poems or how do you write children's books or how do you write an academic paper. Actually, fundamentally, they all look like language, but they are fundamentally quite different language games with quite different rules. So, and I think then, so when I did philosophy, I'm going to just ramble now. So can you just cut all of this out if boring? So in my final year of philosophy, I did logic and mathematical logic. So, we were doing kind of Turing machines. We were doing completeness of force, first order logic. We're doing the linguistic structure of argument. So that was half of it, mathematical logic and logic. And then half of it was feminist philosophy and political philosophy. Mm. Much more wordy, much more, kind of ideas and more. In many ways, I think the problems of feminist philosophy and political philosophy are much more interesting problems. They're just much harder to have any surety over.
Yeah, because
whereas mathematical problems are less interesting, but you can have more surety over
it's
them.
Subjective versus objective, right?
Possibly, possibly. I mean, again, we could have a big argument on that too.
Yeah.
But so really, I think it was that emphasis on language, but quite a lot of the syntactics as well as the semantics of language, what words mean and then how words come together, that's really quite important for large language models. So when I talk about linguistic engineering, imagine you're trying to write a essay on what makes a good podcast.
Mm.
So you go, well, how are you going to write that essay? Well, I might go and read some stuff other people have written on that, I might try and pull out some statistics, I might try and pull out some case studies. I might try and find something from adjacent subject areas, which looks interesting. And then I'm going to want to pull out the right things from all of those things I've read. Plus, I'm going to want to make some stuff up myself. And then I'm going to want to mix that together in actually what's quite well understood around the structure of an essay in terms of an introduction.
It sounds exactly how I wrote my two Evening Standard articles. That's like literally what I did.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it turns out that, with large language models, there are all sorts of ways of shortcutting and speeding up that for the human. Mm. So, so what do I mean by linguistic engineering? So we read as much Cicero as we read the latest stuff on
at AutoGen,
right? Because we're interested in how you persuade and how you write winning prose. And often, a £3 billion contract to build an aircraft carrier can often come down to half a mark on how will you demonstrate corporate social responsibility in your recruitment of engineers to this project.
Oh my god!
Right? So this stuff. How do you write evidence prose? How do you put your best foot forward linguistically, based on previous things that you've written, based on new ideas, and based on the latest public information that's available? That's what I mean by linguistic engineering. Pulling, and a lot of this comes from school studying, like, you know, history, right? You know, kind of, you know, the Weimar Republic was never stable. Discuss. Yeah. Well, you know, kind of, right? Well, I'm going to read some articles on the Weimar Republic. I'm going to find some facts and I'm going to repurpose those depending on whether I want to argue for or against that proposition. So that's what we're particularly interested in, that structure, the what we call lings, the linguistic ingredients, and how you mix them using combinations of large language models to get the desired result. Because turns out getting large language models to write you a poem about a naughty squirrel who goes to the moon is super easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is why people bounce off kind of large language models, which have no kind of clever user interface and don't understand lings, don't understand kind of language. As soon as you try and do anything useful with a unstructured large language model, you realize it's really hard. It's an alignment, AI alignment.
Yeah.
How do you get the AI to do what you want it to do?
Yeah.
And what you want it to do in bid tendering and proposal writing is very specific. Right? Yeah. You want it to win. You need to hit scoring criteria. You need to evidence it. So again, to come back to Wittgenstein and language games, solving the problem of alignment for all language games is a fiendishly difficult problem. In fact, I think if you solve that, you might be at AGI, artificial general intelligence, right? However, solving it for small subsets of language is much easier because you're potentially making the problem much, much smaller. And then you're solving it there, which means you can make a lot of assumptions in context and various other bits and pieces. So I think the future is large language models getting a little bit smarter, but not too much smarter, and we start to see real diminishing returns. And it's all application layer businesses who are all doing specialist stuff.
Mm.
And that's what you'll see is the future of large language models over the next decade.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think struck me most when we first were talking about this like a year and a bit ago, in fact, well over a year ago, actually, year and a half ago, I guess now, was you were telling me at the time that you're hiring prompt engineers, and the prompt engineers that you're hiring, you know, I guess most people would have in those days thought, okay, you're going to hire someone that understands how to write algorithms, how, you know, how they can either code or how they can, you know, speak machine language of some nature. But actually the people that you're hiring were philosophers, were economists, like they were all humanities grads. Is that right?
Exactly. So we want about half my early team were engineers and about half the team were proposal writers, bid writers, humanities graduates. So people who understood how to structure language, how to structure linguistic arguments and what it meant to write corporate prose that wins.
Yeah. And I think this is the thing. I mean, I completely get your point around, you know, yes, it's very easy to get it to write, you know, a bit of twaddle or a bedtime story or whatever it is, but actually getting it to do anything meaningful, like where I found it very useful in the very limited ways that I use it, use LLMs or use certainly ChatGPT, is to repurpose what I've written to either flesh it out, but even then it requires editing thereafter because it still sounds like, I don't know what it sounds like. It sounds like someone who learned English from watching kind of movies or something along those lines, and all the prose comes out as a little bit slightly like it's a bit uncanny valley. I don't know what the right word is for it from a language's perspective, but yeah, it's that sort of uncanny valley. Like you can tell that it's not quite human, even though it looks and sounds like it should be. But where I found it to be most useful is where I apply myself to telling it precisely how I want it to think about a problem and what the outcome of the problem should be or should look like. Because obviously, to an extent, you're also trying to get it to answer the question. Finally, you and I have talked about honesty in business, and we've talked quite a bit about your thoughts on building business. So what is the one piece of advice you would give to young founders who are building today? And also, what is the one thing other than cash, though obviously you don't have much of a shortage of that at the moment, that keeps you up at night?
Yeah, so for young founders, I'd say you need to build something that people want.
And, right, it's kind of obvious, but yeah,
right? And by the way, all of this I know has been said before. So you need to build something that people want, and the only way to find out if people want it is to start trying to sell it to them.
Mm.
So I mean, I invest in a number of businesses. I see a lot of startups, and the classic mistake is to constantly want to twiddle with the product and put more money into the product. And, you know, actually, well, we can't ship it yet. We need to do this, and we can't ship it yet. We need to do this, and we can't ship it yet. We need to do this. You have no idea what you need to do to your product. What you need to do is ship it, find what your first customers tell you need to do, and then do that. Mm. So those very tight feedback loops. And customers want things you didn't think they were going to want.
Yeah.
right? So you need to quickly get out there so you can get their real life feedback and start building things that people actually want. Mm. Otherwise, you can just be in your own bubble, and you know, and I've seen this, you know, all the time. So we created we've got a big extraction feature, which essentially is around reading. Using large language models to read. So if you think someone's got a 200,000 page invitation to tender and we want to just extract the statistics or extract the timelines or extract the scoring criteria. So we built a machine to do this, but it took too long. It takes like 4 minutes, which was too long. And I said, there's various different ways of doing it. And I said, and this is why, you know, nobody's using it. And they said, loads of people are using it, Sean. Well, no, it's not. Well, what I meant is I wasn't using it because I didn't have the patience to wait three or four minutes. Yeah. But actually, it was like a third of our usage was being used.
Yeah, because I mean, like, if it's taking you an hour to do it normally, it's 4 minutes. Yeah, like, that's...
Exactly. It's now for me, you know, if it doesn't happen kind of fairly instantly, if I can't see some results then. So, you know, there's all sorts of times when, you know, customers don't do that. Like at the start of the business, it was great. I essentially built a tool that I would want to use for competitive writing. But increasingly now, I write a tool which is for our thousands of professionals. I mean, it's great. I've got thousands of the world's best writers giving me feedback on my tool every day, like a free research kind of like piece. So for founders, get out to customers quickly, get their feedback quickly. You know, kind of you've got to get out there and start selling a product. And it's much more important to get out with something which is half there.
Or even not at all there, because like you can go out with literally a service without building.
Right, but there's all sorts of stuff you can fix just by being obsessed by customers. Exactly. Yeah. Right. You know, you go, I mean, but that, because it comes back to the honesty thing. I don't want to be giving a customer anything which I can't stand behind and say it does what it says on the tin, and it's, you know, it's genuinely reducing your costs or genuinely increasing your win rate, whatever else it might be. What's the second part of the question?
Second part of the question was, what is the one thing that keeps you up other than cash?
What keeps me up at night? Do you know, as you get bigger, so there's 120 of us at AutoGen AI.
Wow.
I think, you know, increasingly, how do you keep everybody, you know, aligned to the goal of the business? And, you know, small p politics and, you know, kind of like personalities start to, and all humans start. I deliberately started a tech business, so I didn't have to deal with humans anymore, and it's gone terribly wrong. So I think some of those things, you know, and at the end of the day, you know, when you're the boss, ultimately, you know, everyone comes to you, when you're the sort of ultimate arbiter of some of that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, we talk about AI and I've got an AI business, but fundamentally it always comes down to people and how people get on with other, and, you know, kind of how they don't get on with one another and all of that kind of piece. And that's really interesting. How do we stay as task focused as possible while recognizing that we're human animals and human animals are human?
It's incredible that, like, I think the three conversations I've had with founders that we're working with at the moment, yourself included, have all come back with that exact same problem as being the thing that keeps out. How do you keep the team pulling in the same direction? And especially because often these teams are cross-disciplinary, you know, they have, you put a humanities, like, to your point, right? You've got a humanities grad sat next to a, like, really deep kind of, you know, Python, AI, whatever, coder. Like, how do you make sure that beyond just a human connection, that business connection also exists, whereby, you know, they're both trying to achieve the same end? Because the business has obviously an objective, the business, you know, has a purpose, etc. But it doesn't therefore translate that the people within the business necessarily have that same purpose. Like, a lot of people go work in a business because it pays the bills, it pays the mortgage, right? So it's keeping them all aligned and putting in the right direction. Has that gotten easier, harder as you've grown? Because obviously as you grow also, things coalesce a bit more, things become a bit more clear in terms of where the business is going, right? Like, to your point, day one, you might have been writing, I don't know, maybe it was focused on legal proposals and now it's more general proposals or whatever. And you've kind of honed in on what it is that your proposition is, you found your product market fit, etc. It's almost a bit easier to define what the business is. So has that become easier over time, would you say?
Let's see everything through the prism of large language models. It's the context window. And it turns out the context window is everything. Like, you know, if I say, you know, write me a bid you know, kind of clean the floors. If that's in a hospital or if it's in a prison, there's going to be two very different answers, right? So it turns out that in small businesses, when there's three of you sat around a table or six of you sat around a table, you've all got the same context window. And the context window isn't that large because you always talk to one another.
Yep.
As soon as there's 125 people, it's really hard and people have different context windows and nobody knows everything that's going on in the organization. And all of that makes it harder to then, as us human models, to then give an output which is, you know, kind of consistent and all pointing in the same direction. So that would be my large language model kind of response to that, which I think is basically a pretty good metaphor for it. But you know, I say this to my team, my leadership team, all the time.
Yeah.
In my experience, 99.9999% of people who've worked for me, they want to do the right thing. They want to do what you ask them to do. And they will do what you ask them to do. So make sure you ask them to do the right thing.
Okay.
And it turns out, like with large language models, that turns out to be harder than you think it might be.
I can well imagine. Yeah, yeah. I can well imagine. Yeah. Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast today with me. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you? You're on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Are you online? Where are you?
Yeah, so if you do Sean Williams, AutoGen AI, you'll find me on LinkedIn. Link in with me and I will link in with you. Website's AutoGenAI.com. But again, if you Google AutoGen AI, you'll find us.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me in the studio today.
Pleasure. Thank you.